Hi, Paul Fenn. Welcome again to KABU.
Bill, I'm so glad to be here. Thank you for having me again.
Paul Fenn is the thinker, the doer, the innovator who brought to life, first in Massachusetts in 1995, and then around the country, he brought to life one of the most important energy innovations of the 20th century, where he drafted the legislation that authorized community energy. In the Massachusetts legislation, it's called Community Choice Aggregation, in California as well, and a number of other states. Whatever we call it, these enactments authorize the creation of public agencies in cities or counties with the power to replace the corporate utilities in serving the electricity needs of their community, to replace it with community energy, mostly generated by sun and wind technologies. So, Paul Fenn, last week we discussed the origins of community energy. Owed a good deal to you and your work in Massachusetts. And in the many existing community energy cities in Massachusetts and California, where in both states it has grown so much that now over half its inhabitants of those states are now served by public agencies. And now these public agencies are proving themselves as compared to the big plants and big grid of the corporate investor-owned utilities. These cities and counties are proving themselves to be less expensive, more reliable, the energy systems more expensive, more reliable, faster and easier to fully install and repair, and also, what is so necessary, more able to build cultures of energy conservation and use reduction. And this, of course, in order to have a chance of ending the grave, actually existential threat of man-made climate change. In addition, community energy creates the possibility of far more healthy, democratic, sustainable, more fulfilling societies for all its members. Well, then, in the second part of our interview, we'll discuss how, after a period of complacency, the established, immensely profitable and well-connected corporate investor utilities like PGE and Pacific Power and Portland, in the last 10 years, they woke up to realize they're on the road to bankruptcy. Why? Because they are hemorrhaging customers. Because customers were putting solar panels on their roofs. And because community energy agencies were building out public, locally run sun and wind systems. And so these corporate utilities realized they had to destroy community energy and get control of popular solar systems, even on rooftops. And if they didn't, they'd be destroyed themselves. And they prepared for battle. Paul Fenn, tell us about their efforts, how they tried to destroy community energy, and how many community energy cities and states fought back.
Well, it's a fascinating story, in particular in California, but yeah, I was involved in other states as well. So I have 7 or 8 states out of the 9 states that have the law in effect I've been involved with. And the companies differ. So it really depends in some ways on which company you're dealing with. I mean, there are really big utilities, there are smaller utilities, but certainly the big utilities like Pacific Gas and Electric opted to fight against community energy in California. And they did it, as Gandhi said, you know, first they ignore you, then they laugh at you, then they attack you, and then you win. He left out a step, which is that after you win, they co-opt you. And so what the energy industry has done is pretty much follow that path. At first, they just ignored it, and they prevented the discussion of the policy when they were deregulating the California energy industry in 1996. They just kept it off the table and acted like it wasn't there. They used political control to exclude the policy from the discussion when they won the approvals of the bailouts and the deregulation in the mid-90s that led to the current system we have today in most states known as deregulation. Then, fortunately, the market they created caused an energy crisis in California, and that really discredited their position and created the opening for the legislation that I had prepared to be introduced and then to be adopted. So at that point, they turned from ignoring to laughing, right? And that was sort of the stage of obfuscation. They didn't deny your existence, but they essentially stalled state regulators from taking action while they very aggressively sought to establish their market position against the communities. And that had to do with basically increasing their indebtedness, which the customers are guaranteed to pay for, overbuilding power plants, and then creating exit fees from those power plants, and essentially trying to kind of feather their nest of debt, which is really their existence as monopolies. The more that you borrow, the more you're worth, right? That's basically their model. So they borrow their way into this extreme debt so that if anyone tries to leave them, as to communities departing for their own supplies, then they will demand to be paid by all consumers, and the state regulators would protect them and force the communities to pay them to exit. And that, in fact, has happened in California. We had a long-standing fight where we fought to delay their over-procurement of deliberate of power. And, in fact, there is extensive testimony that I gave to the regulators warning them that this was going to happen, and then it did happen. So that led to the so-called power costs and difference adjustment mechanism and all of these insanely obtuse terminologies that the regulators use to justify huge fees on customers, which they've imposed on these aggregations. And so then we got to direct attack, and that was in 2016 when Pacific Gas and Electric was already spending $10 million per county to block these community initiatives locally and using AstroTurf campaigns. Those are essentially fake political campaigns that don't actually have any members. They're just paid fake campaigns to oppose these community initiatives. And then finally, they really doubled down and put down $50 million on Proposition 16 in 2010. And that was one of the largest single entity funded political initiatives in U.S. history. We couldn't raise any money because who protects the public, right? So we formed the opposition, no on 16 campaign, which I think was $125,000 total against their $50 million. But we still beat them at the ballot. So my experience is that the utilities have always used the regulators primarily, the system which they themselves set up after the great crash of 1929. That whole system is an industry innovation, and they use it very effectively. It's essentially an instrument of corruption because most of the commissioners in most states are appointed by the governor, or they're elected, but who the hell knows who their elected commissioner is? No one. So those campaigns are fake democracies. And they tend to side with the utilities and regard themselves as responsible for the fiscal stability of the utilities. And so they're often opponents of community energy. In fact, many state agencies tend to be inclined against community energy, viewing it as outside of their power circles, right? So there's a territorial imperative within these state agencies that kind of augments the utilities' monopoly position, which is purely financial in nature. And they fought very hard and ruthlessly and very dishonestly. They ran Prop 16 as a taxpayer protection measure. It was called Taxpayers' Right to Vote Act and required a supermajority vote of the public. That's 2/3 supermajority in order for the community energy programs to even be considered. It was a huge battle, and after that battle was won, the CEO was fired, the company changed course, and they pretty much since then adapted to this new posture of co-optation where they are creating lots of imitative programs like community solar and 100% renewable products and all these kind of feel-good premium products they offer to customers, always very expensive, but they can appear to be the same or to kind of confuse consumers into thinking they are community energy and sort of exploit the ignorance of the public to confuse them. And anyway, so that's pretty much the status we're in right now.
Yeah, let me list a couple of the other things that I've read about. They've also run initiatives that I know about and studied a little bit in Arizona and Georgia. In Arizona, it was defeated by the Stop the Utility Steal, something like that, headed by Barry Goldwater. It was really a coalition between conservatives and green people, and they stopped it. And in Georgia, it was stopped by what they called the Green Tea Party Alliance. So the Tea Party was very interested in not having the utilities take away their rooftop solar and other ways of sort of trying to absent themselves from the public. And so the Tea Party and the Greens got together and defeated them. This is Bill Resnick of the Old Bull Show on KBOO 90.7 FM, Portland, Oregon. I'm talking to Paul Fenn, who drafted the legislation for community energy in Massachusetts, California. It's called Community Choice Aggregation. And they authorized communities to take over from the corporate utility, like PGE in this area, to take over the responsibility for providing electric power in their area. But the legislation did not authorize money for taking over the poles, the wires, all the apparatuses that deliver energy to homes and businesses. The legislation, in fact, required the community energy agencies to pay a fair price for the delivery service. And we just heard from Paul Fenn that the corporate utilities did everything they could to jack up that delivery cost. And the idea was to jack up the price so they could bankrupt community energy. We discussed that and other ways the investor-owned utilities try to destroy community energy. So the battle is on, and it's constant. The IOUs are trying every which way to destroy community energy, but still community energy is growing. And now the Biden administration is going to have vast impact on that struggle. The Biden administration is proposing to channel great sums of money to the energy sector to develop more green, clean energy and fund other ways of reducing greenhouse gas emissions. And that then leads to the multiple trillion-dollar question, who's going to get that money? What will it be used for? Paul, you examined the Biden plan with a fine-tooth comb. Who's going to get the big dollars?
Amazingly, not renewable energy. In fact, just starting with that, you know, renewable energy is going to funding in the form of the investment tax credit is going to be phased down in the proposal. So it's actually the bottom of my list in terms of the budgeted amounts per category. It's below zero because they're going to reduce it. And so you have this kind of odd phenomenon where when the Biden administration's infrastructure plan talks about clean energy, it actually proposes to build essentially a gigantic grid project, which when we're talking about gigantic, is 20 gigawatts of high voltage lines, which is an immense amount of power. And of course, they say for the sake of clean energy, but they're not actually funding clean energy. And so those utility power lines, that is part of this monopoly electricity system. And so those monies are de facto going to huge corporations to expand the use of centralized generation. They say it's for the purpose of moving clean energy from place to place, but this is a fiction. And every community energy program in America knows it's a fiction. The idea that you need lots of new transmission for green power from far away is totally false and is totally contrary to minimizing climate change, which this plan claims specifically in a very conspicuous way and rhetorical way, to promise that every single dollar spent on infrastructure in this plan would prevent, reduce, and withstand the climate crisis. But here they have, you know, not only this transmission lines, but they say 20,000 miles of road development, under which they include expansion, and specifically justify to reduce traffic congestion. So here again, we're talking about 20,000 miles of road widening, okay? And the climate impacts of that are totally devastating. So the idea that that's somehow a climate measure requires a severe crossing of the eyes. And just looking up and down the actual budget, you have major line item giveaways, the second largest of the whole thing. You know, most of the items are in the $20 billion, $30 billion, $40 billion. It jumps up in certain categories. Manufacturing giveaways, $300 billion. Now, of course, they use some green language in there, but these are to the manufacturing sector, including, I mean, they have a $50 billion gift to fund semiconductor industry. So that's ostensibly going to Intel. These are incredibly wealthy industries that are very rich in investment capital. Why would they invest in semiconductor industry? I mean, I understand the U.S. is no longer as dominant as it used to be in semiconductors, but all of a sudden we're doing semiconductors, and the $50 billion line item is two times the total amount given to what they call ambitious projects in underserved communities. You know, it's two times the budget range for all authentic, what we would call Green New Deal programs. Those are all in the small, you know, one less digit category until you finally have things like $30 billion for pandemic preparation, but you're giving $50 billion to Intel. And so, you know, you have this massive emphasis of the actual dollars on mega infrastructure. You know, $100 billion to connect one-tenth of Americans who don't have broadband. $100 billion? Right? Compared to, you know, again, these $0 figures to protect and restore land. Zero. They mentioned protecting and restore land. There's no dollar figure. There's not even a goal attached to it. Superfund and environmental justice combined, $5 billion, right? But Intel gets 50. And that's the problem, is that to connect the rhetoric to the details, they don't really connect. I think they hire one set of writers who are idealists and one set of economists who are not. And so just looking at the list, you know, the overall...
And one set of corporate bankers as well.
Yeah, that's the problem, is the PR people are really good at seeming like wonderful visionaries, and the corporate bankers who actually provide the dollar figures are quite a different set. And so, you know, small businesses, total support, $31 billion. I mean, that's the entire actual economy, $31 billion. But Amtrak gets $80 billion, right? Okay, I support rail, but Amtrak gets more than all public transit gets. And who uses Amtrak? You know, it's just this ridiculous system compared to the need for subways and, you know, for real transit. So there's just a lack of prioritization on the green climate side of it here. And even there, they're spending on EVs $174 billion compared to $85 billion for public transit. $174 billion. I support electric vehicles, but that's kind of a weird way to put money around. You know, $180 billion on research and development. And then when they go to housing, they always include not just to repair and retrofit buildings, to fix up buildings, but to build new buildings. And when they talk about which kind of buildings they're going to build, it's primarily going to, essentially, to non-poor people. So they have these set-aside funds to protect poor people, but the main funding is, you know, 500,000 home buyers receiving support. Then they have 1 million renters, okay? But there are a lot more poor people than there are middle-class people. So you're giving a few middle-class people, you know, half the resource you're giving to all poor people. It's just you could see how it's weighted. So you have to look at it to weight it. It's not totally draconian in a Trumpian sense, but it's just very weighted to the status quo in terms of climate or justice. You know, $50 billion for all infrastructure resilience. I mean, you get into it, you know, that should be a major core of this thing, and it's just one of the smaller line items. You know, water and wastewater, same thing, $56 billion. And then broadband, $100 billion against, like, broadband? Okay, 1 in 10 Americans can't get fast internet, but why would there be twice the amount that you do for all water and wastewater systems, including lead abatement, right? It's like, Jesus, where are the priorities here? $25 billion going to airports? Who really wants to invest in airports right now? But it's here. So road expansion, airports, and a lot of the money is there, you know, versus Superfund sites, and like I said, an EJ, or for, you know, jobs, underserved communities, $12 billion. They're giving $14 billion to industry, academia, and governments for research, more than they're giving to all jobs in underserved communities. They have this civilian climate corps, which sounds, oh, that sounds kind of exciting. But again, it's really targeted at a certain kind of the middle sector, you know, and just there's no weighting of it. They're giving $15 billion to so-called climate demonstrations, where they say, you know, to demonstrate climate action. That should be the whole plan. They're only giving $15 billion to actual demonstrations of climate action out of this immense sum of money. And so just a total lack of focus on, certainly, as I said, on the green side and on the social equity side. This is not equitable, and it's not green.
You hit it on the head. It's not equitable, and it's not green. The big grid is just it's a lifeline to the investor-owned utilities whose central aim is to make profits by spending lots and lots of money on generation and on their facilities and whatever else they can spend money on, and then, of course, charging customers. This is Bill Resnick again for the Old Mole Show on KABU. I'm talking to Paul Fenn. We so far discussed first how the investor-owned utilities have tried to destroy community energy and how the many community energy cities fought back. And they have fought back because they, in fact, have proven themselves to provide more reliable electricity at less expense, easier and faster to repair and to build out cultures of energy conservation and use reduction. Second, we discussed how the Biden administration has entered the effort to stop global warming. Global warming is actually slow roasting with substantial sums of money, some it seems for reasonably good purposes, a little bit of it, a lot as corporate welfare. It's like we're setting up another military-industrial complex, this one a clean, green energy industrial complex, which will have the same, it seems to me, the same predating that the military industry uses, that is, cost-plus contracts for a big grid that never gets built either, although they may then waive all environmental restrictions on the big grid. I suspect that will be an accompanying piece of legislation so that the utilities can just now lay waste to vast amounts of land and as they cross rivers and forests and the rest. So, Paul Fenn, there's going to be a great battle in the U.S. Congress. That was their plan and their money's thing, but, of course, the appropriations are going to be set in an enormous struggle, probably within the Democratic Party itself, because the Republicans will go along with almost none of it. And in the Democratic Party right now, there's a progressive congressional caucus. It's fairly large. It's one of the strongest caucuses in the Congress, and it's getting more militant and more ready to do battle. Right now, Joe Manson alone can get a huge amount of money for carbon sequestration research. You didn't mention that. And nuclear power.
Advanced nuclear reactor, yeah.
They slip that in as
carbon-free energy. So suddenly they're going to create a clean energy standard that's lower than any most state standards that exclude nuclear from being called clean. So they're actually trying to dilute the standards that exist around renewable energy in the name of renewable energy.
Yeah. Oh, you've really done a good study of it, Paul. I just noticed that they were favorable to nuclear energy and the huge costs.
Yeah.
But that's what the energy industry wants. Huge debt, huge costs, and customers paying. That's their whole mode of operating for the last 100 years, actually.
Well said.
I think, though, there's going to be a battle over the purposes and programs and over the amounts of money. And there surely will be a battle. The question is, how will it be fought, or can the climate action movements, all of them, some climate action movements, of course, basically fronts for the corporate sector, but the real climate action movements, you see a possibility of enough of an upswell to really stiffen the backbone of the congressional progressive caucus so that they play Joe Manson's role? We're not going to vote for the whole thing unless you radically change a lot of your priorities in the bill. Seems to me that's
If they don't, then who will? You know, I mean, I look at this plan and think there are places in this plan where you can see them really putting serious priorities. If you look at the in manufacturing sector, they say they're going to provide debt and equity investment in manufacturing. Okay, that is substantive support for something, debt and equity investment. And it's big money. Well, why can't that be available for local and renewable energy development, energy efficiency build-outs that are underway by all these cities? Why can't they get debt and equity investment from the federal government? You shift over to the schools. Schools are kind of an idol of Democrats, right? Fix up the schools. So they kind of gold-plate that. Direct grants and leverage through bonds. That's the kind of talk we need for climate action. Direct grants, leverage through bonds. Right, we need a financial backstop for states that are going to support municipal investment in local renewables. So that would be a kind of reinsurance of state governments that backstop municipal community energy renewable projects. We have the opportunity to make federal hydropower capacity available as a kind of battery for balancing, supporting local nearby communities that have intermittent renewable systems they're developing, because intermittency is one of the engineering challenges of localization. So federal hydropower agencies could, instead of just selling power, could actually provide balancing on those systems, and it's a very constructive, low-carbon thing to do. And finally, you know, just looking at muni bonds to help municipalities issue green bonds, because they do have these aggregations which involve lots of revenue, so they don't have to raise taxes to issue bonds. They have the revenue from people's electric bills being paid every month. That's a basis for a rebuilding of local economies. And this plan is just a list, and where it gives real resources are on things like highways and transmission lines and a manufacturing and schools, right? But it's not giving it to decarbonization. It's not giving it to the urban core. So it's just, you know, we got to take some of these stronger statements that are applied to the darlings of the Biden administration, where they're getting all the money, and not just money and cash, but debt, equity investment, direct grants, leverage through bonds. That's the real verbiage of meaningful action by government. And that's what we need on the climate side. And that's not building transmission. That should be removed. We should not build any new transmission, in my opinion, in the United States. We should be upgrading local low-voltage distribution systems. This money is earmarked only for high voltage. That's the transmission systems that cut a football field thousands of miles across this country, wherever they go. And they're talking about also using federal power to force those towers onto communities, in effect. So this is a fast-tracking and a massive funding of transmission. That has to be, in my opinion, that's not acceptable. So this kind of money needs to be placed in the building retrofit side, where they have basically pennies on the dollar right now, where they have very token gifts to various, you know, EJ, environmental justice, Superfund sites, little $5 billion here, $5 billion there. Wrong priorities. I think they've got to fight the fight on this and really ask for a lot of change in this plan. Everyone's afraid of Republican opposition, but the issue here is just whether we're going to have both sides representing nothing for the climate crisis, or if one side will and is willing to lose a political battle for the sake of recognition that the climate emergency is an emergency and it's time to stop the double talk.
Well, Fenn, thanks so much for talking to you today. I hope you get active in working with those forces who are ready to, within the Biden administration, ready to insist on very different priorities.
I would love to. Paul, I'm real focused on the local level, but this now is a time that I would find this to be very important, and I'd be happy to help if anyone's interested.
Yeah. Well, Fenn, thanks a lot for talking to us. It's been very enlightening and surely provides the basis for actual climate action. So thanks a lot.
Well, I'm really, really glad to know you. It was a pleasure. I hope we do it again sometime.
Until then, so long.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.